And we are joined now by the wonderful Linda Pearl. Linda, how are you today?
Very well. Thanks.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us. You have been all over the globe the past few weeks and few months,
We have. It's been, I tell you, we've been cranking up the mileage. Yeah, it was crazy. You know, so much of life, it's just, doing your little workouts and your laundry and getting to the answering your emails. But this last while, it's been really great. I don't know. Sometimes your fairy godfather just gets into action. And this has been the case for the last while. I got to go to London. There's a play, a one woman show called The Year of Magical Thinking. It's a 1 hour and 40 minute or so monologue. It's written by Joan Didion, a great American writer who passed away in the not so distant past. And she suffered extraordinary losses, and being a writer, she dove in and really metabolized her grief through the process of writing, turned it into what became a best-selling book for a long, long time in the New York Times bestseller list. And then she was a wonderful New York producer commanded her to turn it into a play, which she did. And Vanessa Redgrave originated the role in the West End and then New York. And then I got to do the West Coast premiere years ago, like 10 years ago. And as what happened at the moment when my own mother was dying. So it was a soulful, journey, especially because of that. And then I've got to do it several times over the last few years, not over the past 5 years, maybe 4 years, certainly during the pandemic. But then this lovely producer that we had worked for last year just gave me the opportunity to do it in London. So, and I, for someone else, it wouldn't have been, how we all have our bucket list. Well, doing a play in London was really a bucket list for me. And somehow to do this play, it was a short run. It was a small theater. But it was, it was a big life box ticked for me. And one of the interesting things to go on endlessly about this play is that there were a lot of young people that came, a lot of young people, like in their 20s and their 30s. The UK is a literary society, and this is based on a literary work. So I think that was part of it. But what would draw a young audience to this play? Many of them, just chat with them after the show, and they had suffered losses or themselves and were just struggling with how to. So, and at this point in life, you want to be involved with anything that's meaningful, and especially when it comes to your art. So for all of those reasons, it was fun. Then Patrick and I came back to the States and did a few things for a few days. Then we went over to Monaco. There's an amazing TV festival de Monte Carlo. It's an annual event. And Patrick had been before. I never had. And we've been doing sort of recurring role on Bold and Beautiful. So we were over there representing that show. And it's a really cool event. I mean, besides being just an outrageously beautiful, tiny country, they know how to do events. They really do. This event that went on for about a week had full of plenary discussions and awards and lots of press. But the focus of it was television and documentary films making a difference. That I don't think there were feature films involved. No, just TV and documentaries, that on TV, various platforms. And it was started by Prince Rainier and now continued by his son. And anyway, we played dress up. I mean, usually it's, hopefully your audience can't see me because I look like garbage. But anyway, t-shirts and jeans. But this was high heels and makeup and hairdo and bling. And Patrick was, it was so much fun. And so now we're back kind of just flattened and grateful.
So you've done so much in the acting world. Twofold, what was kind of your motivation to get into acting? And then kind of take us through, just so the audience can hear everything you've done, just in the various aspects and niches of it. Because some people might know you just from a TV show, but you're way more than that.
Well, thank you. First and foremost, I'm a mommy. That's just the best, most illuminating, most challenging, most rewarding, spiritually deepening aspect of life. So that's first.
My wife and I just took our 2-year-old to Disney.
Whew. Oh my.
Greatest 3 days ever.
Oh, wonderful.
Whole new perspective on 2-year-olds.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh, you just blew his little mind. Oh my god.
Incredible.
Oh man, that's good for you. That's great. Yeah, building memories, right? That's it. Let's see. Well, what did I do? My parents loved the theater. Mother had been a ballerina. My dad had been raised on the road. Although that's not where they had their career. He moved to Japan, where I was raised for his career. And so it was an art-centric community. So we went to the theater. My parents did play readings in the house a lot. We had artists come stay with us. So it was kind of in the mix. And I started working in Japan as a kid. I was sort of an anomaly. Usually foreigners, certainly then, would just stay. Their companies would just have them there for a couple of years. If you were military, which we were not, you were there for shorter. But there were a handful of families that stayed there for decades. My parents were there for about 30 years. I spoke the language. I grew up there. And also Japan learning English was kind of a curiosity and a kind of a fad at that time. So I did a TV series. Many people did on the Educational Channel, teaching English. I wasn't teaching. I was just there as kind of a gimmick because I had good American accent, oddly enough. And, you know, I had yellow hair and these funny color eyeballs and I worked in the theater there. So that was kind of my training ground. Went to England as a teenager and studied there, which was kind of a nice bridge between my training in Japan, which was very classically oriented, very formally oriented. So England was too. It was quite, formal, certainly as compared to what was happening in New York, which was actor studio and neighborhood playhouse. Then I went to the States lived in New York and studied at both of those places. Neighborhood playhouse. I was 16 when I moved to New York. And so neighborhood playhouse was way over my head. The Lee Strasberg Institute, was a little more manageable for me. I mean, it was culture shock. It was, really antithetical to any of my training and experience. But anyway, you take all these different disciplines and, for anything that any of us do, and then you kind of make it your own, right?
Right, for sure. I want to throw a couple things at you, and it's kind of here, first thing that comes to mind when you hear it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is Happy Days.
Oh,
take us back to that little journey.
Sure. I had Donnie Most had become a friend. We'd worked together in New York, and the instant he turned 18, and then I did shortly after, he moved to L.A. 18, because once you were 18 in L.A., it was just easier to work.
Yeah.
My girlfriend and I followed, and Donnie was sort of like, well, where do you live and how do you get an apartment? And so he kind of shepherded my girlfriend and myself through that process. And then he very kindly, he got, Happy Days, and a few months into it or weeks or whatever, he called and he said, oh, there's a role for Ron Howard's girlfriend. So he introduced me to the casting director. I ended up doing that role for first and second, however long, anyway, for a while. Gloria, that character's name. Then Ron left the show, which meant that all of his supporting characters were out of a job, certainly me. Years later, I went back as a different character, as Ashley, as Fonzie's fiance. So, but, you know, having been a part of the show early on, those, I would say, lifelong friendships developed out of that. Ted McGinley and Jimmy Dunn, who was one of the writers and producers. Anson, Donnie. Donnie is a wonderful singer. I like to sing too, so we do concerts together every once in a while. Marion Ross, you know, Tom Bosley, while he was still with us. Anyway, they were just lovely friendships. And Gary Marshall was an extraordinary producer. He was a life lesson. He was a walking life lesson to see how he held the reins of that show. He created a wonderful family atmosphere. It was always joyful. Jerry Paris, our primary director, was also very much responsible for that. And when you walk onto that soundstage on the Paramount lot, it was as though everybody just dropped their earth weights. You know, everybody had stuff going on in their lives with,
of course,
from big to small, but it just wasn't brought onto the set. That was an escape. It was a pink bubble. It was fun. It was innocent. And I think a lot of the humor was made possible because that was the atmosphere. And Gary, who's a baseball fanatic, created a softball team, and you had to be on the team no matter what level you played at. And, you know, you put on a pair of shorts and you go and make a fool of yourself on the pitch, or is that what you call it, on the field, whatever,
as
I do regularly. And Henry would too. Henry is talented on many levels. He would be the first to say, not as an athlete. You know, the playing field gets leveled. It just, there's no room for ego. You know, it's an equal opportunity situation in which to be completely humiliated. But it was fun. And we got to do USO tours and stuff like that. So it was service oriented, but it was part of Gary's wisdom to just have these things that we could do that would just remind us, oh yeah, we're not that special. We're lucky, but we're not that special. So it was great. And in Monte Carlo, you know, there we are halfway around the world, and we're fans there with photographs. And I would say a good 80% of the photos that people had me sign anyway, had to do with Happy Days. So, okay. I mean, Happy Days is coming up on its 50th anniversary now. And to think of its, you know, that it's endured globally for this long. Anyway, it was a real treat to have been a part of it.
One of the other amazing, and you've worked with so many amazing people, but one of the other amazing people you've worked with was Angela Lansbury on Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
Do you have any Angela stories that you can share with us?
Well, she was a great lady. And, you know, I think for, you know, any of us in our youth, you have those people, your group of elders, your, that one teacher that makes a difference, that, you know, one artist, whatever, that, you know, engineer, scientist, whoever it is, that uncle, the crazy uncle. So Angela was one of those people, I think, for so many. I worked with her when I was fairly young a few times. And she, it's like, oh, you go, oh, that's how you're supposed to do it. That's the right way to do it. That's the high road. So what she would do, and she didn't tell me this, but she just saw to it that people on her set, if they wanted to move ahead in their careers, if there was anything she could do authentically to help them, she did it. So the sound editor, who, you know, had spent his career listening to dialogue, he knew what good dialogue was, and he knew what worked in the mouth of an actor. He wanted to write. He wrote a script. She saw to it that it got produced as an episode. That meant that he was now a member of the Writers Guild and, you know, was pedigreed and could move forward. The costume, the set costume girls all had a chance to design an episode. That meant they had that on their resume and they could move forward. And the same thing with assistant directors. They all got a chance to direct. So, and those are just the few that I'm aware of. I'm sure there were many more. We were doing a scene one day. And so when you're filming, at least in the traditional way, you film a master. So if you or I in a room together, the camera would capture both of us sitting and chatting. Then they would break down, and then they would turn around and shoot your close-up for which I'm sitting off camera so that we can speak our dialogue. And then they turn around and get my close-up. You would be off camera. And it is traditional for the actor to stick around and do the off-camera to give the actor who is on camera the best shot at, you know, well, acting with a partner.
Right.
So, but it's not imperative. You're not on camera. So if you have to go, if you have a plane to catch or your son's softball game or something, you know, it's very permissible to leave. Well, Angela had root canal surgery that day. We had shot the master. We had shot her close up. She left the set to do root canal over lunch. They shot some other things. Now they came back and they were shooting my close up. And she came back, face full of Novocaine, and sat off camera to do my, so that I could do the scene with her. I didn't need her there. She was a huge star. It was her show. There was, you know, who does that? And it's the dedication to the work. It was that English can-do spirit. You know, it was the right thing to do, and then some. Anyway. It's like, oh, okay. That's the standard.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Walk us through how The Office first kind of came on your radar. Did your agent, one of those things where the agent just kind of tells you about it? Were you familiar with The Office? And what was that audition like for you?
I knew about the show. I'd never seen it. And so I was just called in. I went in to audition and they were so nice. But I was sure I wasn't going to get it, you know, but then I did. And it was so much fun. They were a great cast. And unlike Happy Days, you know, because I'd been a part of the show at the very beginning, it was a known atmosphere to step back into. Not the case with The Office. I mean, they had this huge success. So I was very nervous going in. First day of school, what's it going to be like? And there were many things that, you know, strike you immediately. The set was so alive. It was so joyful. And I really think Steve set the tone there. And also the fact that so many of the actors were also writers. If they weren't writers, they were musicians. There was usually a fantastic jam session going on during lunch. So there were multi-talented, smart people involved in that show. It was also when I did it, my son, you know, was no longer, he was in those special teen years, which I have to say, I got off really easy with him. But having, you know, being on The Office, I achieved like a new status of cool. So like if we'd go, you know, skiing or something, the boarders were like, hey, there's Pam's mom. And I got some cred with my son for a little while, a few years there. But yeah, it was great. And Steve, there's this story I like to tell about him because, again, it was one of those life lessons of, oh, that's what you're supposed to do. So, you know, he was so successful in his feature film career was starting. And that's a hard transition to make. Certainly one I never made from TV to feature. Anyway, Steve was, you know, that was happening for him. And he had been offered a feature film, which would have meant that he couldn't do the next season of The Office. And he turned it down. And I don't know, maybe they waited for him. Maybe he got to do it, but it's an extremely risky thing, extremely risky because we're all, you know, replaceable as actors. They could have got somebody else. And there was someone else to do the role Steve was going to do. But anyway, he turned it down. And so that he could tell the writers and the, you know, the powers that be on The Office that he was going to leave. He was going to give them one more year, at which point he would leave. So what that meant was, and he was legally, he was not obligated to stay on. His contract was up for renegotiation, so he could just have left, and nobody would have thought anything of it. I mean, it's the thing to do. But by staying on for a year, he gave everybody a chance to plan financially, you know, that they weren't blindsided as you most often are by this business. If you have a steady gig, it gets canceled, you know, overnight. And suddenly, how do you pay your mortgage, your kids' tuition, you know, your parents' nursing care, whatever it is. So they had a chance to sort of brace themselves. And the writers a chance to kind of morph the show, ease Steve out, ease the new people in. So it was a, it was an extraordinary thing to do. Really, I've actually never heard of anyone doing that, but Steve did. So that's a measure of the man.
Yeah, and it is, like you said, it's such a scary thing in Hollywood because you're never guaranteed your next role. So when you have one in front of you, for him to be like, no, I'll put this off for now, hoping other things come around, you never know. Yeah. So that's an incredible story. Mm-hmm. Having worked in different TV shows and kind of seeing the evolution of TV, and this is something we talk about on this podcast a lot, and I'm really curious to hear your opinion. A lot of times you hear the narrative, TV today isn't what it was back in the 80s or the 90s. Like, those are the TV shows that reminisce and that people grab onto. And I'm curious, from an actor's point of view, do you think it's more nostalgia, or do you think there is something to that? Has the quality of family TV show gone away today?
Well, I think probably so. Yeah. I mean, there are shows that are much harder hitting than there were certainly back in the 70s, 80s, maybe even 90s. Yeah, 90s. But also with the streaming platform and the diversification of platforms on which to watch. I mean, we had in the 70s, whenever, you know, there was just the three networks and then eventually four networks. That was it. So there was a really good possibility that some big chunk of the population would be watching the same shows, ergo would have that same sort of collective consciousness conversation. That's not the case anymore. I mean, so many times people will say, have you watched this show? It's fantastic. I've never heard of it. And vice versa. So, I mean, with all the shows that you can see from England and the variety of shows is just, there's so much out there, and there's no way we're all going to be watching a majority of the same shows. And I think that, you know, the filming has changed too. Office is a point in case. The camera was more often than not on a steady cam, which meant the camera was moving. So the feel of the show, the visual paradigm from which shows are shot now are very different from what it used to be. So there's a lot more movement. There's much more freedom of ideas. I think there's something out there for everyone, which was not necessarily the case. The other thing I have to say, as a white woman, a real benefit of how the industry has changed is that there's a truer representation now on screens, big and large, of what the fabric of America and the world look like. I mean, when I was in my 20s, if I turned on a television channel, I would see myself, a version of myself, my age group, my coloring, my whatever, body language, in a commercial, in a show. If I had been an African-American young woman, African-American contemporaries at that time, they would open a magazine, they would turn on the channel and basically not see themselves. Same for Asian, Hispanic, you name it. Not even getting into, you know, gay characters or trans characters. So, which is important. It's crucial for the arts to be a more honest reflection of what's going on in our society. Who's partaking? Who's there? Whose ideas, you know, whose perspective? I mean, that's the duty of the arts, is to stretch all of our perspectives, whether or not we're ready, and probably especially if we're not ready. So. For sure. TV has really taken a dynamic lurch forward on that front.
And before we let you get out of here, tell our listeners, what are you up to now? Future products, future projects. Where can we see you? Where can we find you?
Thank you so much. Well, let's see. I have a new album coming out at the end of August. It's called This Could Be the Start. And that'll be on wherever you get, I don't know, iTunes or Apple or Spotify or wherever those things are. Anyway, I'm really excited about that. It was so much fun to do. It's jazz, and basically we do American pop tunes, but in a jazz feel. So that's a deep passion of mine. I love to do concerts, and this is, you know, representative of some of the stuff that we do in concert. So that's fun. And then Patrick, my partner, Patrick Duffy, and I started this company almost a year ago called Duffy's Dough, and it's we sell online at duffysdough.com. Please go. Please buy. In fact, we have a sale going on right now, 15% off. Anyway, it's a dehydrated sourdough starter. So you get your kit, you have recipes and stuff, and you make the starter from which you can make pretty much anything, baguettes or pizza crusts or croutons or rolls, cinnamon rolls, pancakes, and it's really hearty. And anyway, it's yummy, and it's been fun to do. 100% of our profits go to charity, food scarcity charities. So that's our, you know, our mission behind it is to make a difference. So we're hoping, really hoping, on bended knee, hoping that we, you know, stir sales and that people come visit us there and check us out. So
awesome.
Pretty much it. Well, oh, the Linda, Instagram and, you know.
Oh, you know. Linda, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris. You have a good day.